Previously on The Accidental Terrorist. The year is 1986. Our hero, Elder Bill Shun, is a 19-year-old Mormon missionary from Utah, newly arrived in Alberta and devastated to be separated from his 20-year-old former drill team hottie fiancé. But that doesn't inoculate him against the enticing forbidden fruit to be found in the prairie oil town of Brooks, namely the gammon vixen Heidi, she of the plunging neckline, whom he met whilst knocking on doors with his cowboyish trainer Elder Fowler. In today's episode, we sink deeper into the dreary routine that is missionary life, and perhaps pay a return visit on Heidi's enchanted cottage. The Accidental Terrorist, a memoir by William Shun. Chapter 6, Letter and Spirit. "Swan this other construction site," said Elder Fowler. "A bunch of us are one story up on the frame. This dude Chuck, he's welding something, and he takes a bad step back and falls off. This is an office building with a big concrete apron, and he lands sitting down on this piece of rebar sticking straight up. 8 inches, right up the ass." "Judas Proust," I said, and shuddered. We were marching down a street of picturesque little houses in the crisp October morning. My suit jacket did nothing to ward off the goosebumps, and with the stack of blue books I carried, I couldn't even rub my hands together for warmth. Fowler chuckled. "Funniest thing I ever saw. The rest of us stood around cracking jokes while the fireman tried to get him off." "He lived?" "Oh, sure," Fowler said with a wave of his hand. "He kept telling us to stop making him laugh because that made it hurt worse. And when the fireman tried cutting the rebar with a blowtorch, oh man, that just heated it up and started cooking his guts. It took him hours to get him free." He consulted the pack of index cards in his hand. "Okay, here's the next one." I turned up the walk and I knocked at the door with my sphincter clenched tight. Routine is the watchword of missionary life, and it hadn't taken us long to settle into one. Each day began, as dictated by the White Bible, at 6:30. It began again at 9-minute intervals until about 7, when we stopped hitting the snooze button and finally hauled ourselves out of bed. Freshly showered, shaved, and fed, we would carry our steaming mugs of postum to the living room for companionship study amidst the mismatched, donated furniture. Why I started drinking a coffee substitute when I hadn't drunk coffee in the first place, I will never know. The White Bible specified an hour of joint study and an hour of individual study each morning, from 7:30 to 9:30. I would be fully dressed except for a tie, but Elder Fowler often forewent his white shirt in the morning, letting his garment top hang out.
Our garments, the sacred white underwear we wore next to our skin, were constant reminders of covenants we had sworn in the temple during our endowment ceremonies. Covenants to live up to such ideals as obedience, selflessness, and chastity. I wasn't comfortable with the casual irreverence many Mormons displayed toward their garments, perhaps because my father had the habit of lounging around in nothing but, and I always kept mine covered up at home. Of course,
even the most lackadaisical saint would never dream of exposing his garments in public. The simple symbols stitched into the fabric were not for Gentile eyes. Our first study goal was for me to pass off all 6 discussions, the set of lessons our investigators, read initiates or victims, needed to hear before baptism. I had gotten well underway on this one at the MTC and was close to completing it. It helped that I only had to know the main concepts each discussion touched on and the scriptural references to back them up. In the old days, when my father was a missionary, there were a couple dozen discussions covering all sorts of doctrinal minutiae, each one of which had to be delivered word for word. In the intervening years, the church had grown savvy enough to simplify the process for the sake of both the missionary and the investigator. We covered only the major doctrinal topics now, and not with very much depth. Fowler and I would role-play teaching situations to sharpen skills like addressing concerns of investigators, or building relationships of trust. Then there was the ever-important testifying by the Spirit. It was the Spirit, after all, that brought about conversion, never persuasive argument. And the best way to summon the Spirit was to deliver heartfelt testimony of your own faith and convictions. You would say something like, "Brother and Sister Craven, I want to tell you that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the things we've been teaching you are true. I know that Joseph Smith was a true prophet of God, and that the Book of Mormon is the most correct of any book on earth, given to us by the Lord in these last days to stand hand in hand with the Bible as another testament of Christ. I know this because I've read and studied and pondered and prayed, and the Lord has sent His Spirit to speak to my heart and let me know these things are true." With all present enveloped in the warm, happy glow of candid sharing, the time was right to transition from testifying by the Spirit to identifying the Spirit. "Do you feel that, Brother and Sister Rube? Do you feel that warm burning in your heart that's grown as I've been speaking? That's the Holy Ghost, testifying to you that the things we're telling you are true. Now, pay attention this afternoon after we leave, because you'll probably notice that good feeling diminish. That's because, until you've been baptized and received the gift of the Holy Ghost by the laying on of hands, the Holy Ghost can't always be with you. It can visit from time to time to help point the way toward what's right, but only after baptism will you have it to call upon as your constant companion." It was rather like martial arts training, but not quite such good exercise. For that, we would cut our individual scripture reading short 3 mornings a week and head to the Brooks Racquet Club. Joining a gym was strictly against the rules, but as Elder Fowler pointed out, how could our minds and spirits stay fit if our bodies didn't too? And if a great missionary like Elder Fowler thought it was a good idea, I was perfectly willing to join in. I had never been much interested in, nor much good at sports of any kind, but under Elder Fowler's tutelage, I had begun to develop into a halfway decent racquetball player. I only managed to beat him every 7th game or so, but for someone as uncoordinated as I, that was like pulling down Olympic bronze in effort. Fowler was a patient teacher, and with his long reach, a formidable opponent. I surprised myself by starting to enjoy racquetball. After 45 minutes to an hour on the court, we'd retire to the weight room for a short workout, then head downstairs to the lounge to cool off in front of the projection TV with a Canada Dry ginger ale. We'd watch adult contemporary music videos on VH1 and let the burn subside in companionable silence. At 10 in the morning, we were usually the only ones there. After about half an hour of decadent lassitude, Elder Fowler and I would exchange glances, heave heavy sighs, and push back our chairs. Our carefree interlude was over, and it was time to head back to the pit for a shower and a change of clothes. Then it was time for proselytizing hours to start. The White Bible exhorted us to at least 70 hours of proselytizing per week, every one of which had to be accounted for and reported to our district leader each Sunday night. Our dominant proselytizing activity any given day was likely to be tracting. 18 hours a week was the minimum, but we often did more simply because if we didn't have anyone to teach, there wasn't much else we could do. My loathing for tracting grew with every minute that dragged by, but so did my capacity for it. As I mastered the basic door approaches, I learned to recognize and defend against our most commonly encountered opponents. There was the born-again Christian, who insisted that Mormons worshipped a different Jesus, but would pray for us anyway. The scriptorian, an argumentative cuss who could prove any point by appeal to the Bible. The amused or annoyed atheist, who would agree to read the Book of Mormon on condition we join him for a cup of coffee. The Protestant minister, whose attempts at counter-conversion led only to an awkward détente. The credulous fundamentalist, loaded down with inflammatory tracts explaining how Mormons swore oaths to Satan in their temples and wanted to drag you down with them to hell. And the bitter old recluse, spittle flying from his lips as he screamed incomprehensible threats against our trespassing asses. But these confrontations were like the brief explosions of action in a baseball game, startling and infrequent, separated by long stretches of drudgery and boredom. Between those fleeting moments of drama came encounters with children and the elderly, with the feeble-minded and the infirm, with the day sleeper and the non-English speaker, and even with that twitching curtain which indicates our quarry is home but not answering the door. Separating those came the curt dismissal, the vague hostility, and the simple polite disinterest. To help those difficult hours pass, we sometimes made bets. Who could place the most books that afternoon? How many doors would pass before someone yelled at us? How many words we'd get out before the next door slammed? But mostly we just talked. Often we talked about home, movies, music, school, girls. But what was most useful was when Fowler passed along mission wisdom, gossip, and folklore. Our conversation took a surprising turn in that direction once from hard rock. "There's really only one band I can stand that plays that kind of stuff," I was saying. "Rush." "So you're a Rush fan," said Fowler. "Just like everyone else in Canada, missionaries too. Last winter they had a date scheduled in Edmonton. Power Windows tour," I said. "That was a great show. I saw it in Salt Lake City." "Be glad. I was in Edmonton then, and it seemed like every elder inside of 50 miles had a ticket to the show. Must have been three-quarters of the North and South zones, both." "Including you?" "Nah, Rush ain't my thing. But anyway, the day of the show, this massive snowstorm hits town, shuts everything down. No planes in or out of the airport. Rush can't get there. Concert canceled."
"Whoa,"
I said. "No kidding. Do you think God wanted all those missionaries bucking out at a rock concert? No way. It would have killed the spirit dead for a month." Times like that, I was happy I had Fowler for a trainer. His experience and homespun wisdom inspired confidence, like a sergeant in Vietnam who against the odds had survived to the end of his tour. I liked having that perspective, that practical know-how on my side, as opposed to the out-of-touch platitudes of some district or zone leader, a goofball who'd been away from the front for so long that he'd forgotten what life in the trenches was all about. Fowler never skipped past an unappealing home, never let an antagonist draw him into an unproductive Bible bash, and never got mad at me no matter how badly I butchered my door approach. I couldn't have asked for a better companion. Not all our tracting proceeded with blind monotony. Once a week or so, Elder Fowler would gather up our placement cards, and we'd set out on the directed monotony of callbacks, following up with those few souls who actually accepted a Book of Mormon from us the first time around. When we appeared at their doors, the usual response was that they hadn't yet read the passages we had asked them to. On occasion, we scored the touchback, teaching a first discussion, but rarely were we invited back for a second. Fowler, good sergeant that he was, would let me see his disappointment, but never any discouragement. That's what we were doing the morning Fowler told the rebar story. I could feel the ridges of that phantom steel rod perforating my intestines as I reached with the golf ball to knock on the door he had directed us to. The setting looked familiar. "Hey," I said, "isn't this..." "Heidi," said Fowler, consulting his index card. "Right, Heidi," I said, "rebar forgotten." My pulse quickened. If any contact in this town was golden, Heidi was the one. I knocked. I stood as if expecting the sun to emerge from a bank of clouds. The door opened a crack, and I breathed out, ready to inhale Heidi's heady bouquet as she recognized us and emerged. But instead, it was with a timid, creeping shadow of her former exuberance that she greeted us. She stayed half-hidden behind the door, not meeting our eyes, no welcoming decolletage in evidence. "Can I help you?" she said. "Hello," I said, glancing back at Elder Fowler in confusion. "We're, Elder Shun and Elder Fowler, if you remember, from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." "I'm sorry," Heidi said, clinging to the edge of the door. "My boyfriend says I'm not supposed to talk to you." "Did you read the verses we marked for you?" I asked, but the door was already closing. "I'm sorry," she said, and gently she sealed herself back inside. We continued on our way, only now I felt the rebar through my heart.
At least there was still mail to look forward to, and the possibility of a letter from Katrina.
With phone calls forbidden, we could legally communicate only by mail. Every day without a letter was a day without sun. Every day with, one of birdsong and wildflowers. It had taken more than a week after our arrival in Brooks for Katrina's first letter to reach me. The moment I found that magic scrap of origami waiting patiently in the mailbox, folded in the shape of a minor miracle, I felt my heart cough and stutter into motion as if the blood had lain stagnant in my veins since the day I left Utah. If a day without mail was bad, a day without mail when Elder Fowler scored big was even worse. Elder Fowler didn't seem to mind when he got air mail, as we called it, but I would mope through the afternoon like a lonely old dog. But the mail usually flowed in a steady stream. My father and mother each wrote once a week, and most days I could expect a letter from at least one sibling. Katrina's mother, Colleen, regularly sent me packages and sage advice, and friends back home and in other missions wrote me as well. I even got a welcome letter from Andy Kilmer in Belo Horizonte, Brazil. He told me in the first paragraph that I was a dick for not having written more often. Now that I was in the field myself, I had to admit he was right. Katrina was by far my most frequent correspondent, outpacing the runner-up, my father, at least twofold. I wrote to her nearly every other day, and she wrote me almost as often. Every letter she sent was a promise, a lure, a revelation. My every response a roadmap of love, longing, and sublimated lust. Not that it was all sweetness and light. Sometimes her chronicles of everyday events seemed to mock me by their very remove from my lifestyle. Her account of an aha concert she attended with friends pained me like an infidelity, as if my own asceticism demanded the same of her. Her report of the movie Blue Velvet, which that hellion friend Michelle dragged her to see, made me fear for the fate of her precious, corruptible soul. Mostly, though, her letters melted me like chocolate in a warm hand. When she told me she loved Crocodile Dundee because for once she didn't have to be jealous of the happy ending, I walked on air the rest of the day. When she told me my weightlifting made her feel comforted and safe, I hit the gym even harder than before. And when she told me I reminded her of Timothy Hutton, and she used Deborah Winger as her return address, I knew I could never possibly feel more secure about the survival of our love.
We spent the majority of our evenings and Sunday afternoons visiting local member families.
Our ostensible purpose was to teach practice discussions, but in the process of setting up these appointments, we usually managed to wangle an invitation to dinner as well. Simple or elaborate fare, exciting and spicy, or bland as paste, we didn't care. We always ate what we were served, we always said thank you, and we always took seconds when offered. The members were blessed for their support of the missionaries, and who were we to scoff at a gift for God? Not only that, but it saved us money. It was usually more nutritious than what we might cook for ourselves, and best of all, we could count the dinner appointment as pros time. All we had to do was extract a commitment from the members to discuss the gospel with their non-member friends, and extracting commitments was much easier with folks who already believed we were messengers from God. On those evenings when no DA presented itself, we might stop by the local trailer park to drop in on the Whitaker family. Every ward, Fowler assured me, had at least one cool family who loved nothing better than having the missionaries hang out. Brother Whitaker was winsomely unpleasant, while his cheerful, pretty wife never seemed to notice she was living in a mobile home with shag carpeting in various shades of vomit. Sister Whitaker became like a mom away from home, always asking about our families and fixing us tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwiches. The only problem with our visits, aside from the occasional accidental glimpse of some television program, was that the oldest of their three daughters seemed to have a crush on me. Millie was only 13, so I didn't worry about it turning into my GC, but it still made me uncomfortable from time to time, particularly her insistence that I looked like her current heartthrob, Kevin Bacon. Nothing I said could persuade her I looked more like Timothy Hutton. "Look," she said in the front room of the trailer on one occasion, thrusting the latest issue of Tiger Beat under my nose. "That looks just like you on the cover." It was a particularly unflattering picture of Kevin Bacon, at least to my eye. But with reluctance, I admitted a certain superficial resemblance. Brother Whitaker put aside his paper and rose from his easy chair to peer over his daughter's shoulder. "Can't say's I agree," he volunteered. "This here elder's 10 times uglier than that freak, eh?" Hands down, Monday was the best day of any week. That was our preparation day, or P-Day. According to the White Bible, P-Day was our day to shop, clean, and do laundry. Only when those chores were done could we devote some of the rest of the day to recreation, and only then in approved pursuits. In the evening at 6:30 sharp, P-Day ended, after which we were expected to get back to work. On my first Monday in the field, I had arisen as usual and put on my suit pants, a white shirt, and a tie. Fowler spotted me in the living room, reading my scriptures, as he made his bleary-eyed way to the bathroom. "What are you doing, Elder?" he asked me. He was dressed in just his garments. "What do you mean?" "Your whites." He meant my pross clothes, which we called whites, naval fashion, even though our suits were dark. "Why you have them on? It's P-Day." I blinked. "Well, the White Bible..." Fowler waved to cut me off. "Yeah, the White Bible, I know. We wear our whites in public at all times, even on P-Day, except for recreational activities that make them inappropriate. Hang the White Bible. I don't know a single missionary who wears his whites on P-Day, and you won't break that tradition, Elder." I grinned. "Twist my arm. And another thing while we're at it. P-Day does not run from 9:30 to 6:30 like you might have heard. It starts when we get up, whenever that is, and it ends when we go to bed. Those are the rules. Don't look at me, I didn't make them." When he was done in the bathroom, he went back to bed. Around 11 that first P-Day morning, Elder Fowler and I loaded our dirty clothes into the car and drove to the nearest self-service laundry, a distance of about 3 grimy blocks. As we pushed through the swinging glass doors, Fowler said, "If you don't mind, we can save money by doing our colors together in one load and our whites together in another." This time, when he said whites, he meant just our shirts and our underwear. "Fine with me," I said. We shared the laundry with a couple of sullen housewives who kept their distance, even though we were dressed in jeans and sweatshirts. Fowler wore cowboy boots that had seen plenty of use. My mother had sewn me a homemade laundry bag, complete with drawstring, but it was clear from the way half a week's load stretched its seams that I'd need a bigger one. As I dumped out the clothes and began to sort them, Fowler leaned close and said in a low voice, "One more thing, and this is very important. Never, and I mean never, do we leave our wash unattended. If one of us wants to step outside for a Coke, that's fine, but the other has to stay here." What could be so important that it trumped the rule about always staying with your companion? "Gosh, okay," I said. "How come?" Fowler smiled grimly and nodded. I think he appreciated that I agreed first and asked why second. He looked around and lowered his voice further. "This happened in another city a few years back," he said. "I heard about it from one of my companions, who had a friend in that mission. Kansas City or somewheres." He shook his head, as if to say I wouldn't believe my ears. "Anyway, there were these two elders doing their wash on P-Day, and when the stuff came out of the machine and went into the dryer, they headed down the street to grab a sandwich. What they didn't know was this really nasty anti-Mormon couple owned the laundromat. When they came back from lunch, they found..." He glanced around again and lowered his voice even more, despite that there was no one in earshot. "They found their garments on display in the front window, with a big sign saying, 'Check out the Magic Mormon underwear!'" My stomach made a fist. I pictured the garments taped to the front windows, spread-eagled and obscene like flayed human skins. "Judas Proust!" I whispered. "What the flip did they do?" "What could they do? They called their prez and told him what happened, and he called Salt Lake, and pretty soon the word came back down the chain what they needed to do."
"What was it?"
"The prez gets these elders back on the phone and tells them to go out in front of the laundromat late that night and shake off the dust of their feet."
"Shake off the dust of their feet?" Yeah, you know, like the disciples used to do in the New Testament when some city tossed them out on their ears. It's an actual priesthood ordinance, though you don't hear about it much. What's it supposed to do? It's a testimony against the wicked. Fowler shrugged. Don't ask me how it works, but within a week, the laundromat burned to the ground, and that's a fact. I was overawed by the implications of this disquieting anecdote. To think that such terrifying evil was loose in the world, and we were caught up in a battle against it. My brain reeled. Holy smokes! I cried. You said it, pard. Fowler nodded and pulled his crumpled suits out of his laundry bag, one blue and one brown. Now here's a real miracle for you. These steel-belted suits of mine? Before my horrified eyes, Fowler tossed both suits into the washing machine with our colored clothes. No dry clean? That's 100% polyester. Can't hurt it with a blowtorch. And he was right. His suits came out of the dryer with nary a wrinkle. And never for one second did I let them, or any of the rest of our clothing, out of my sight. We tried to mix up the recreational portion of our P-Days. One week we drove north to the Alberta Badlands and hiked around taking pictures of all the dinosaur fossils. Another week we did some duck watching and tossed a frisbee down at Kinbrook Island Provincial Park. Still another week, careful no members spotted us, we sneaked into the local pool hall for a burger and some video games. When we had our fill of that, we went bowling. When that got old, we headed to the stationery store downtown to shop the cheap paperback racks. My reading habit amounted to 2 or 3 SF novels a week, and Fowler's, nourished on slim Louis L'Amour's, was even greater. This was so against the rules it was hard to justify, except on grounds we might both have gone crazy otherwise. We limited our extra-scriptural reading to the hour or two before sleep, but still we managed to go through plenty of books. As a consequence, we had searched out every book outlet in town, and the stationery store, with its inexplicable wire racks of romances, mysteries, westerns, and science fiction, was one of the best. That day someone new was at the register, a hefty middle-aged woman in polyester. "Hi, Elder, I'm Sister Frank," she said when I brought a copy of Thomas M. Dish's On Wings of Song to the front counter. She smoothed her jowls with one hand as she shook my hand with the other. "I recognized you and your companion from church. I guess it's your P-Day, eh?" "That's right," I said, and I began to stop worrying she might report us for reading non-church literature. "So, you like science fiction, Elder?" "Very much," I said. "In fact, I write it." "Oh, my word!" Her excitement verged on giddiness. I almost expected her to flutter a hand in front of her face. "Did you ever publish anything?" "I had a story in this little book called LDSF2 last year. It's the second in a series. It's all science fiction for Mormons." Sister Frank shook her head. "Oh, how wonderful, Elder. I love sci-fi, but the new stuff is also filthy all the time, you know? Even Isaac Asimov is all about sex these days. Just sex, 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 sex. I can only read the older stuff, from before all the sex." "Have you ever read Orson Scott Card?" I asked. "Who's that?" I felt an urgent missionary zeal, more so than I ever had while tracting. "He writes science fiction. He's LDS. "You're kidding! Wait, let me write that down." She reached for a pad of paper. "Orson Scott Card. I highly recommend Ender's Game. Nothing offensive in it at all. There's a sequel, too. It came out just before I left on my mission. Speaker of the Dead, or something like that." "Great. I'll look for them. Thank you, Elder." "No problem." As Fowler and I left the stationery store, I was whistling. The joy of sharing what I'd found to be worthy was profound. I made a mental note to look for some of Card's earlier novels soon at the library. That would make good bedtime reading. One night in late October, the telephone interrupted my evening reading. This happened two or three times a week, and I was getting tired of it. I looked across the living room to the kitchen table, where Elder Fowler sat laboring over a letter with MoTab on his headphones. He signaled that I should get the phone. I rolled my eyes and answered it. LDS Missionaries, Elder Shun speaking. "Hi, Elder Shun," said the lascivious voice that I'd known to expect. "It's Sister Yautz in Calgary. What's going down?" "Not much, just reading," I said, tapping my foot. "Cool. Sister Nyland wanted to chat with Elder Fowler for a bit. Just thought I'd say hi first. Here she is." A 50-foot cord connected the phone to the jack. I took the phone to the kitchen table. Fowler removed his headphones, thanked me, and carried the phone into the bedroom. He shut the door behind him. I sat back on the couch and tried to find my place again in my novel. I was lonely. I was jealous. I wished I had someone else to talk to, someone in the mission I could call up just to chat. I would have loved to catch up with Elder Vickers, who'd been sent all the way to Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories with his trainer, as far north from Calgary as Calgary was from Salt Lake City. But I didn't have his number, and the mission office didn't give out that information. I figured Sister Nyland had gotten our number from Roper or Hill, the sisters who preceded us. I sat in the living room long after Fowler returned the phone to its place and went to bed. "Glass rod be damned," I thought, and lifted the phone into my lap. I picked up the receiver and with trembling fingers dialed 801 and Katrina's number.
"Hello?"
said a sweet, sleepy voice, staticky with distance. She might have been on the moon, so insubstantial did she sound. I sighed in relief that it was her and not one of her parents, but my breath hitched in my throat.
"Hi,"
I said. My skin was cold and tight. "Have I by any chance reached my fiancé?"
"Bill?"
"Bill!" Katrina squealed, and I held the receiver away from my ear. We talked for an hour. It was the shortest hour of my life.
Next time on The Accidental Terrorist.
In our next installment, we travel with Elder Shun to the city of Medicine Hat,
where he'll meet the other missionaries in his district for the first time. As he knocks on doors with his district leader, Elder Gass, we'll track out questions like, why are the other missionaries making fun of poor Elder Shun? Why does Elder Gass want him to rat out Elder Fowler? How many BYU coeds does it take to screw in a light bulb? And what about Bob? The skull-splitting answers.
Just 1 week from now! The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2006-2009 by William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.